You know, I am all about those little pick-me-ups throughout the day. Whether it's conquering work tasks or doing chores around the house, I need a little treat to reward me. It is a must. And you know what gets me smiling every time? Japanese snacks. Not only are they bursting with flavor, but the cute packaging and quirky vibes add an extra layer of fun. That is why teaming up with Boxu, a Japanese snack subscription box, has been an absolute delight. And these aren't your run-of-the-mill grocery store snacks, okay? Every month, Boxu brings you over 20 unique treats that you can normally find only in Japan. Plus, they throw in a nifty guide packed with info about each snack and Japanese culture. So you get to snack while you learn? Are you kidding? This was literally made for me. Oh, and by the way, each box ships straight from Japan, straight to your door. Okay, so I'm going to try one of the snacks for you. I got my little guide right here. I think this week I'm going to go for the Soka Senbei Uma Zarame. This Senbei rice cracker boasts a uniquely irresistibly tart and sweet flavor combination of ume Japanese plum and zarame, a coarse granulated sugar. Cool. Now, this says it contains wheat and soy, so that's good to know for you gluten folks. There are plenty of gluten-free snacks in here. Here's the cracker. Ooh, this looks so good. Let me give it a try. Oh my God. You hear that crunch? It's like tart. It's a little salty. It's a little sweet. Mmm. This is delicious. Mmm. And I never would have gotten to try this if Boxu hadn't sent it straight to my house. Mm. And you know, my favorite thing about Boxu is that they support small family-run businesses in Japan. Boxu has sourced your treats by working with over 245 small makers in Japan, helping out their businesses and helping to preserve their traditions. So if you love trying new and interesting things, or if you know somebody who does, you have got to try out Boxu and get these snacks shipped straight from Japan to your door. And right now, you can use the code FACTUALLY for $15 off your first order on Boxu.com. That's code FACTUALLY for $15 off your first order on Boxu.com. That's BOKKSU.com.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
I don't know the truth!
Factually, I'm Adam Conover, and you know, if you listen to politicians, tech titans, and crazy uncles around the country, the robots are going to take over. Supposedly, a revolution in artificial intelligence is transforming our economy, making human workers unnecessary, right? I mean, robots don't need healthcare or a minimum wage or job security. AI doesn't need regular bathroom breaks or even bathrooms at all. And hey, best of all, AI would never betray you, you titan of industry, and form one of those pesky unions. Hey, you can straight up program them to never go on strike. Wow, the perfect employee. Humans are screwed, right? Well, the truth is, this story of encroaching AI supremacy has been a bit oversold. Let's say radically oversold. The fact is, it is extremely difficult to develop AI that can perform even basic tasks a human can. And, you know, if you want a worker that doesn't get healthcare or bathroom breaks, you know, you can just not give those to a human worker.
So as a result, it's often cheaper and easier to just pay exploited human workers peanuts than it is to design, deploy, and debug a multi-billion dollar technical solution, and it likely will be for a long time. Take Uber, for example. You know, they've long teased this future where they replace human drivers with super self-driving cars, and Wall Street is so convinced that that's the future of the company that their self-driving car unit is valued at over $7 billion. But look, even if you ignore the fact that Uber's executives have been charged with stealing their self-driving technology from Google, and the fact that one of their AI cars killed a person in 2018 because it was too stupid to realize it needed to hit the brakes, the idea of Uber replacing all of their drivers with a self-driving fleet is still pretty far-fetched. You know, a while back, I was actually chatting with someone who works at Uber, and they told me, kind of on the DL, so I'm kind of blowing them up a little bit, apologies, they told me that the demand for rides is far too high for them to ever handle it entirely with automated vehicles. Think about it. Uber provides 15 million rides a day. So, which is cheaper? Building and maintaining a fleet of millions of cutting-edge, high-tech, autonomous vehicles, or paying human drivers less than minimum wage to supply and drive their own Toyota Corollas? I think I know which one I'd pick, and I think that they are picking it right now. They're going to go with the humans. Or let's take another example. AI boosters have long promised that artificial intelligence will soon do things like translate text from one language to another, or transcribe audio, or identify objects in photos and videos. But right now, humans are still much, much better at those things, and humans are being paid pennies to do them on Amazon's Mechanical Turk website. The Mechanical Turk is a site that tech companies can use to farm out repetitive tasks to an army of actual humans who are being paid literally $4 to $5 an hour. You know, from a bird's eye view, it kind of looks like AI, except that the actual work is being done by people being paid poverty wages, which makes Mechanical Turk a bit of an on-the-nose name, since the original Mechanical Turk was a chess-playing robot that wowed audiences who didn't realize it was actually being controlled by a very cramped human chess player hidden inside. Well, the truth is, we are living in a Mechanical Turk economy. Underneath the shiny veneer of our sleek, futuristic technosphere, there is a massive underclass of workers who are performing so many of the tasks we assume are being done by algorithms, or that we just don't think about at all. For instance, you might not realize that every time you log into Facebook and Twitter, there is a gigantic, poorly paid army of laborers making sure that your feed isn't clogged with spam and porn. Without them, the internet would be a nightmare of busted links and offensive content, or at least more of a nightmare of busted links and offensive content. But who are these folks? Where do they come from? And how do big tech companies keep them hidden out of sight? Well, our guest today has done pioneering work on the people who keep our social media feeds clean and the effects of that work on their lives and livelihood. Sarah T. Roberts is a professor of information studies at UCLA and the author of Behind the Screen: Content Moderation in the Shadows of Social Media. Please welcome Sarah T. Roberts. Sarah, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me. This is great.
So tell me about your work. What is it that you do?
So I'm a professor at UCLA, and my purview there is to be a researcher of the labor of the internet. For a lot of people, that might sound like an oxymoron, because what labor really is involved in a thing that's all computers?
Mm-hmm.
I've been looking at my particular area of this issue for about a decade, and I can tell you that the internet, in addition to computers, is made up of a lot of human activity, which we don't see. And the particular facet of that that I look at are people who sit in between us as users and the platform as sort of a distributor, and review all the stuff that we upload to those platforms that we think we're just going to kind of seamlessly share with the world. These are people called content moderators, and the people who do it for pay and as a job or as a profession, I call commercial content moderators. And I can tell you that if you haven't heard of this job, that is by design. It's because it's a pretty miserable job, by and large. It means that human beings are sort of in a position to be the mediators of oftentimes some things that at best are maybe boring or rote, and at worst can be really nasty and upsetting material.
Well, I want to hear what kind of material you're talking about. But yeah, first of all, this is not a job that I conceived of existing before encountering your work. We sort of have this idea, well, when someone posts something on Facebook, there's an algorithm that sorts it and determines whether or not you see it. People are clicking a flag button maybe, and that's, you know, kicking it up in the algorithm's hierarchy or whatever. But for the most part, we believe, and these companies present themselves as being just dumb pipes. Hey, people post and we show it to you. The end, free speech, do what you will. Nothing else going on here.
Yeah,
look, but that's
over
not
there.
The reality.
Look over there. Don't look over here. I think, you know, there are facets to what you just described that have truth in this ecosystem, but it's not as simple as the industry would have us believe. Like I said, I've been looking at it for like a decade, and in that time, there's been quite an evolution in terms of what is possible with technology. Mm-hmm. If we were having this conversation in 2010, I'd tell you pretty unequivocally that computers would be largely useless in this kind of analysis. Like, wow. Is this good or bad? But in that time, the biggest players in the industry, the Facebooks, the Googles, those who have the resources, meaning money, computation, and employees to put on this problem, have really accelerated the capabilities of what you're talking about, which is like computational decision making. That having been said, how do you train the algorithm to know where the line is with something like hate speech,
right,
which we as a society cannot come to terms of agreement
even,
on, right?
Even people can't agree on what it counts. Yeah,
that's right. So part of the issue that is kind of baked into this scenario is that on the front end of what they're trying to maybe solve for, there might be certain social issues that are fairly intractable. And it's like just ramping up computation on that isn't going to, you know, believe it or not, bring world peace.
You're going to need people to do it at the end of the day. Just like I was talking about in the intro, where like there's jobs where like, hey, you just need a lot of people to do them, and you can get it. You can get people cheaper than you can computation in a lot of cases if you're willing to drive it down that much.
I mean, there's really an economic dimension here too, where mm-hmm. there's a calculus done, like what is the return on investment of putting the entire apparatus that was supposed to be designing cool new functionality onto resolving what constitutes a picture of breastfeeding and what somebody showing sexy skin,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Like, so the companies themselves have sort of...
That's not what the engineers who are like, oh, wow, I work at Google and I'm going to work on the coolest new shit. Like, that's not what they are interested in.
This is probably not like the glamour side of the industry. And it's especially not that for the people who are doing the human side of it. So, mm-hmm. Like, on the one hand, we have this... You know, this is what I think you're getting at in this program. There's this like aspirational quality that industry has sort of promulgated for at least the past 5 years that, hey, the algorithm, first of all, is a better decision maker. It does better than humans, or at least it does it at scale or more efficiently or something. And therefore, we're always just on the cusp, right? Mm-hmm. We're always just almost there. And maybe somebody's going to get hit by the self-driving car on the way to that. Maybe that's part of, part of like the collateral that...
I mean, people, it's literally framed that way. I was tweeting about the woman who was killed by the Uber, by the Uber self-driving car. And it, you know, we now have data from the Federal Highway or NHTSA, perhaps, federal agency that reviewed it, that said that according to the data, it could not recognize that it was a pedestrian with a bicycle, didn't know what she was, wasn't programmed to recognize that a pedestrian could be in that place on that road. And I had people, I was just tweeting about this, you know, that like, you know, the real danger of AI is that we're going to all trust that it's superhumanly powerful when really it's just got the same biases and blind spots as the dumbass humans who designed it.
Right.
And I had people in my mentions saying, AI is so much more safe than a human driver that we should accept this one death and move forward with that program, because think of all the deaths that'll happen if we don't do that. Therefore, this is collateral damage that's acceptable to us. That, like, you know, because according to this person's hypothesis, that's literally just comes from Elon Musk tweeting about this, right? Like, where is the evidence that self-driving cars are 100% safer than human drivers? What studies have been done on this? This is just blind trust of technology. But according to that person, that means that, oh, we should, any criticism of artificial intelligence is by definition going to kill people. It's a ludicrous assertion, but that is like the utopian, like a halo that's been given to AI for so long.
I mean, boom, right? I feel like, first of all, I'll just, I'm going to slip into your mentions and try to, like, reorient. I mean, I was fighting my own battle this week around a similar issue, which had to do, you're probably aware of this too, of the tech exec who applied for the new Apple credit card, and his wife, he and his wife share all financials, have for decades. She, in fact, has a better credit score, and he got a higher credit limit by many, many factors. You know, I want to say 10 times more, but it could have been 100, and somebody fact check me on that. But the point is, you know, where's the evidence of improvement, and by whose metric is the thing an improvement? Mm-hmm. And what, you know, we're running into a situation where those measures of improvement are set up by the same coterie, small coterie of people who envision the problem space also, right? Mm-hmm. You know, I think of someone like Elon Musk, who lives in LA, and we've got rampant homelessness. We've got a traffic gridlock that almost had me not getting here. And what's his solution? Going to Mars and, like, making private tunnels under the city in an yeah. earthquake zone. Like, yeah. Who vetted this?
Yeah.
But, you know, one of the things that what your comment and your kind of interaction with your Twitter followers got help you.
This is one out of 100 replies I got. My Twitter followers are smart people. You know?
I live on Twitter, and, you know, it's just what it is. You know, one of the things that I pointed out in that commentary that I think is also relevant here is that, you know, we, quote unquote, are willing to put some of the most precarious folks on the line in this experimentation. Like,
right.
Like who doesn't fit in the algorithm? Well, in the case of Uber, it might be people with different body shapes, right? Mm-hmm. Or when we do facial recognition, it's people with certain skin tones yep. that don't match, or who disproportionately match yep. in a database, right? Yep. So we've got, like, these scholars out there, many of whom are my colleagues, who are pointing out, you know, and have been, like, sending up these signal flares about these warnings. And I mean, my hat's off to the gentleman who raised the issue about his credit score, because he's a white dude, a tech millionaire,
yeah.
married in a, you know, heterosexual marriage to a woman who said, hey, I'm getting screwed too. And by doing that, you know, he kind of brought everyone else along. But yeah. I think that calculus is really disturbing. Like, who's disposable along the way
for real
to get to this utopia that is always just out of reach?
Right. Right. Yeah. Like, the, what is this promise that we are blindly swallowing of the self-drive? What is the self-driving car future actually, right? Like, what is it actually going to be? If he is allowed to build exactly the thing that he wants to build, what will the world look like? Because that has not actually been described to us. We've gotten the 3D rendered, you know, planning ahead version. We've got the little mini movie that they've made, but we know just from watching what's happened with his own projects that, like, the gap between that and reality is enormous. So what is the actual future that we will get if we allow that to continue untrammeled? And it's not something that we actually have been presented with. We haven't actually dived into what that is.
And nor so delved.
What are we sacrificing those lives for?
Yeah.
It's not clear.
I think one of the, you know, in all of the confusion and obfuscation around the issues that you raise, you know, one thing that seems to have surfaced for me is that whatever that future looks like, it's not going to be one that is envisioned to be equally distributed throughout society. Mm-hmm. So when we're thinking about some of his other projects, pet projects, and those of peers, you know.
Dunking on Elon Musk is like such a recurring topic on this podcast.
Yeah,
so
I'm in the right place.
let's talk about your actual work, because, yeah. Man, I could go off on the big picture issues here. This is a wonderful conversation.
Yeah, I'm happy to chat about that anytime.
But let's talk about, no, we'll get back to it, but let's talk about these specific content moderators. Like for a site like Facebook employs these folks?
Yes.
And how many people are we talking and what is it that they're doing?
So, you know, it's difficult to nail down numbers, but I think in the tens of thousands is a fair assessment.
Tens of thousands
for Facebook specifically. And, you know, when we think about some of the big players in the industry, so that's not counting Instagram, which is another property that Facebook owns. That's not counting something like YouTube. That's not counting people doing content moderation activity for other properties for Google. So you can see that, you know, if we take in the tens of thousands for one of these major platforms and we kind of multiply it up, you see that we get at some pretty significant numbers. So Facebook definitely has an entire ecosystem, and kind of speaking earlier about the ability of firms to build their own in-house algorithmic or AI-informed tools, they are also players in that space. So what they have is something of a hybrid ecosystem where algorithms, machine learning, informed tools, other kinds of computational tools are definitely used, but humans are also a fundamental mission critical part of that ecosystem, whether it's like being generalists on the front end where they're on a live production floor and they're looking at content as it gets flagged and put into a queue and they're making a decision that has kind of an instantaneous effect, or more and more that they might be an employee looking at a curated data set and making decisions about that data set to go to inform that machine learning tool that will then go to ideally, at the very least, support or maybe even replace some of that human activity.
But at the end of the day, there's a certain extent to which it doesn't matter, right? Like whether they're That's doing right. all of the moderation manually in front of their laptop, or if they're at the end point of some complex algorithm that's giving them shit to look at the end of their, you know, at their laptop, they're still sitting there. We still have tens of thousands of people spending hundreds of thousands of person hours a day, right, looking at this content.
You got it.
So where are these people? Who are they? And what is their day-to-day? What does it look like?
One of my earliest findings in the process of doing my research was that there wasn't a one-size-fits-all solution, that industry was kind of bootstrapping or having like this patchwork mechanism to meet their needs. And so they were doing a number of things. One of the things they were doing was kind of creating teams within their HQs. This would be, in the case of the companies we're talking about, this would be in Silicon Valley. So they were hiring folks, usually through contracting companies, though, right? Mm-hmm. So they weren't direct.
Of course, they're not direct employees.
They were not direct employees. Keep the company lean, right, for Wall Street. But they're bringing in these folks as contractors, probably limited term. But these people were coming to and from the on-site facility and working there, maybe down the hall from engineering or some other place in the building. So there was a group of people like that. There were people doing this work sort of with third-party boutique specialist firms. That was another crew of people. And sometimes those firms were providing social media management across the board, including creating content or seeding content for companies that didn't have the desire. Then we had folks working in what might come to somebody's imagination if they think about this, which is the call center environment. Mm-hmm. Call centers are not just in Southeast Asia. They're not just in Manila, but they certainly are there. That's, in fact, like the call center capital of the world, and particularly for the American market. But I was finding evidence of these call centers in places like West Ames, Iowa, which is like pretty much next door to a cornfield or maybe a soybean field. Facebook has a site in Austin, Texas. That's another big site. There are places all over the United States, weirdly, who see their competition as places like India. So this company I discovered in Iowa, its tagline, it was called Caleres back in the early 2010s. It's changed hands and names many times. But its tagline was outsourced to Iowa, not India. And I was just like, wow. As a researcher, that was a gold mine. And if you're listening, students, take screenshots because they were going to change that stuff.
Now, how should we feel about that? Because obviously, you know, many American workers have negative feelings about outsourcing, right? But if it's, and so, okay, great. Hey, call center America, union made call center, right? Perhaps I'm sure it's not a unionized call center,
but
you know, you've got that, maybe there's that Buy American halo around it, except that then when you say they're competing with India, but then wait, how low wage can these jobs be?
Well, you know, back in the early 2010s, when I found out about this this Iowa-based site through a New York Times article, they were reporting wages around like $9.75. Mm-hmm. You know, so pretty low, no benefits. Of course, that's many times greater than what a comparable employee in a place like the Philippines would earn.
Mm-hmm.
But what that company Caleres was effectively doing was selling its value add to its business-to-business customers as being exactly what you're getting at, which is the Americanness, and not just any Americanness, not those fancy highfalutin East Coasters.
Iowa, down home, yeah. Mike Huckabee.
I mean, people, folks cannot see me, but these are people who could be my cousins. I'm from Wisconsin. You know, we're corn fed.
Yeah.
We're hearty, salt of the earth. That's what they were selling. I mean, the xenophobia was present. Like, don't outsource it to these unknown others in other parts of the world. Keep it in Iowa. I mean, I think the people in that call center would have rather been on their family farms, but they lost those in the 80s.
Yep. And the Rust Belt where, you know, factories are collapsing and et cetera. And it almost looks like you've got these companies saying like, oh, hold on a second. There's a lot of exploited Americans without jobs who will be willing to work for pennies, you know?
That's right. And the exploitation goes up the chain in the sense that there's a stratified system wherever you find this work, even when the conditions are markedly better. So, for example, the group of people I talked to in Silicon Valley, their gig was probably nicer in material terms than the people in Iowa. They weren't making much money at all, however, compared to their peers. And these were people who were required by the company they worked for to have a 4-year university degree from places like Berkeley, USC, private liberal arts colleges. And these poor saps, you know, had graduated with journalism degrees, econ, history. So, you know, they made some bad life choices, strapped with student debt. And so they were ripe for this work, too. And they even brought an even higher level maybe of cultural knowledge or context.
It's really funny that it's like no matter whether you're in the Philippines or you're in Iowa or you're in San Francisco Bay Area, there are folks trying to push your wages down, trying to there's a way to get fucked no matter where you live, to put it bluntly. Because I know people who have those jobs who are highly educated, highly trained, but are making low enough money they can't possibly pay back their loans.
That's right.
They can't live in those cities. They have 2-hour commutes, that kind of thing.
I'll go you one step further, which is that it's the very fact that they're strapped with those loans that makes them open to such a shit job in the first place.
Right.
So the folks that I talked to who were working at a company that I called Megatech, which obviously is a pseudonym, they said things to me like, it beats being a barista, which is what I was doing.
Yeah.
Although that, you know, later on, that kind of, it's sort of a Faustian bargain. Like, does it actually beat being a barista? Well, maybe marginally, maybe economically, slightly there's an edge, or maybe like you get to sit at a desk all day and say you work at Megatech and that has cachet.
Yeah.
But what's the actual cost on you in terms of the psychological impact? I mean, it sucks slinging coffee, but you're not exposed to child abuse.
Yeah.
Most most of the time.
Right. Okay. So let's talk about that. Let's talk about, Starbucks, say maybe not the best, but they try to make their baristas kind of happy there. Right. And they're definitely not making them look at images of horrible images that people are posting on Facebook all day long. So what is that work like that these folks are doing, these contractors are doing, and what effect does that have on them?
So that's, that's something that has also experienced an evolution. In the early days, it really was just like an open pipeline in the sense that, as users, we might see something that we find disturbing. That doesn't happen that often. But when you aggregate that over the millions and millions of people who are on the platform at a given moment, now the numbers start to get great that people mm-hmm. are reporting dangerous, abusive, maybe pornographic, violent content. All of that would just kind of go into a queue. And, we wouldn't ever kind of know the end result or really think about it again. But there were people on the other side sort of receiving that.
Having to watch all of it.
Yeah. And in those early days, again, it wasn't really very sophisticated in terms of any triaging or how that stuff would necessarily get sorted. And so it was the case, for example, that there might be something as a worker that you really have a hard time with. I'll give an example. In my case, it would be animal abuse. That's just a thing that I have no capacity to deal with.
Yeah.
There would have been no way for me to kind of self-select out of the animal abuse reports mm-hmm. in the early days. So there are improvements around that. But by and large, for these generalists who are sort of the kind of lowest level grunt workers, they are sitting in front of a screen and they are reacting. They're in a reactive mode to stuff that's already been flagged. A lot of that could be false positives. Somebody's pissed at their friend and they start reporting all their posts as being, they're gaming it or whatever. Yeah,
so this stuff actually does need to be filtered.
Yeah, it needs to be filtered.
We need to be able to tell the difference between good and bad.
Right. But, in intermingled in that are things that are legitimately frightening, things that no one should have to see, certainly not over and over again. And so, full disclosure, I'm not trained in psychology. I'm not a psychologist, but I am a human and, I have empathy and I could understand what people were reporting to me. And in part because I've been on the internet for almost 30 years, I clicked rogue clicked on stuff I thought was one thing and saw it and it was something else. It's messed me up all the time. Yeah. So, these folks would tell me, I can handle this job. I'm okay with it. I've mm-hmm. come to terms with it. I can do it. Other people can't do it. I can do it. And I take that on face value. And then 20 minutes later, the same guy would say to me, I've really been avoiding hanging out with my friends since I have this job because whenever I'm in a social situation, we just invariably talk about work and I don't want to talk about work. I don't mm-hmm. even want to tell people what I do. Not to mention they're all under non-disclosure agreements, by the way.
Yeah.
So not only are they under the NDA, but they didn't want to freak their friends out with the stuff they were seeing. It's not fun to be like, I saw a kid get the shit beat out of them
But I can imagine. I mean, that's bad socially, right? And we've done work on my show about how, loneliness is a health mm-hmm. condition, right? Mm-hmm. That if something's impacting you that socially, that can actually hurt your health. But, there's a lot of unpleasant jobs. I'm sure, garbage men come home smelling like shit. There is that part of it. And, there are some jobs that we all accept need to be done that way. And those are unfortunate jobs. And hopefully people get them that are able to handle them. But at the same time, I can imagine the psychological effect of this. Like when I think of, the one or two or three things that I've seen on the internet that truly upset me, videos where I accidentally saw someone being killed or, some really, I don't even want to go into it. I'm thinking about it right now.
Yeah.
It's like upsetting to think about. Yeah. And like you click away, like, oh my God. And then it like flashes back to you. I have a couple clips like that. If you're seeing hundreds of those a day, that can't help but have a psychological toll on you. And you're seeing ones that no one else is even seeing. You're not clicking on a YouTube link. You're not, at least when you're watching, if you watch like a beheading video or something, which is, I think, the example probably a lot of people can come to mind, but those get spread around and, a million people click on them. They're on 4chan or whatever. But when you're just watching like, hey, someone uploaded to YouTube a video of them abusing an animal, abusing a child, anything like that. Like, my God, that must be really take a toll.
I mean, I think it does. And I think, you know, your point is really accurate in terms of, look, for better or for worse, our society is set up where some people have shit jobs, right? Mm-hmm. That's, I would say it's for worse, but we know that's a fact of life. There are also people who, as a kind of a precondition of the work that they do, know they're going to encounter horrible stuff. So we might think of, you know, a homicide detective or something right. like that. But in the cases that we might think of as analogs, you know, at least the people are visible mm-hmm. and at least they're understood in their social role. The issue for so many of the commercial content moderators that I talk to is not only are they taking this on and really taking it on the chin in so many ways on behalf of the rest of us, but the way that the ecosystem has been set up is to really render their work invisible. The way to be a good content moderator is to leave no trace. Mm-hmm. And this links us directly back to the front end of our conversation where we were talking about because the better mode for the companies or from their logic and perspective is for people, if they think about it at all, to think a computer did it, not yeah. a human. So these folks have to operate leaving no trace, not acknowledging or being acknowledged for the work that they do on behalf of others. And really, you know, it, by the terms of the NDA, but also just by basic sociality, keeping it to themselves. And yeah. it, human beings are not designed to do that. I mean, that's going to come out of the seams somewhere. I talked to a woman who used to do this work for a little company that was called MySpace, which is like really taking us back, which happened to be located in LA too. It was over on the West Side. And she told me.
Of course it was.
Yeah, right. Over by the boring company tunnel. And she told me, you know, she's gone into bookkeeping. Okay. She's a bookkeeper. She doesn't do any work having to do really with computers per se. And she said, look, my thing is this. I don't really even want to work in an office setting because I don't know if the person who's in the cube next to me maybe did this work at some point and will later on have, you know, kind of crack or have a flashback or have some ill effect of the wow. work that he or she did 10 years ago. Yeah. This is
from her experience having
yes,
done this work.
Yes. And, you know, we talked quite a bit. Her name is Roz. She's fantastic. And I write about her in the book. You know, she had so many interesting insights. One of the things she said to me too, she said, look, after I quit that job for 3 years, when I met people, I would refuse to shake their hand. And she kind of looked at me knowingly. And I was like, I'm not totally sure what she means. So I said, you know, tell mm-hmm. me more. And she said, well, look, I've seen videos of what people do and people are nasty.
Wow.
So, you know, that's the way that the effects might yeah. manifest themselves, just changing your orientation to the world. I mean, on the one hand, there's the threat of having damage done where you become so sensitive and you're so kind of harmed and unable to deal with the content. But I often think about what's another potential outcome here? Well, the potential outcome is being totally desensitized.
Yeah.
Where you're no longer effective because things sort of roll off your back. I don't want legions of people like that walking around. And I think yeah. that's what she was getting at too.
Right. Well, there's a deeper hypocrisy here on the part of these tech companies, that I want to dive into, but I have to take a quick break.
Sure.
So after this ad break, come right back and you're going to hear me rant about something that makes me very angry. All right, we'll be right back.
Folks, today's sponsor is one I cannot recommend highly enough, Delete Me. As a Factually listener, you know how much I value online privacy. Well, Delete Me has been an indispensable tool for me for many years. I've been using them long before they even started advertising on this show. This day and age, it is shockingly simple for data brokers to peddle your personal information without your consent. These data brokers may be selling your name, phone number, and home address, and you might never even know it's happening. Trying to locate and remove all this data yourself can feel like an impossible task, but that is where Delete Me shines. Their team of experts tirelessly scour the web to track down and wipe out your personal data. In just 7 days, you will receive a detailed report of their findings. And believe it or not, a whopping 41% of Americans are vulnerable to online harassment, from doxing to scams and even identity theft. In some cases, having your info online can turn cyber stalking into good old-fashioned in-person stalking. Protect yourself from these threats with Delete Me. So if you're like me and you value your personal privacy, you want to make sure that your identifying personal details are not floating around the internet where anybody can buy them, Well, you can get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/Adam and use promo code Adam at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/Adam, code Adam. I wholeheartedly recommend this service. Check out Delete Me. Today's show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Our lives are super demanding these days. I know that I constantly catch myself wishing for extra hours in the day. But here's the thing. The problem isn't as simple as lack of time. It's that we often have trouble prioritizing what's actually important to us, whether that's seeing friends, talking to family, or even kicking back with a good book. This is one of the ways that therapy can be so valuable. Working with a professional can help you figure out your priorities and make time for the stuff that really matters. And therapy isn't just for big trauma. We can all use a little help, whether it's learning to deal with stress, setting boundaries, or just getting stuff off your chest. So if you're thinking about giving therapy a shot, you might check out BetterHelp. They say it's all online, super flexible, and fits right into your busy life. You just answer a few questions, and they say that they will hook you up with a licensed therapist. Plus, you can switch therapists at any time, no extra charge. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/factually today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/factually. Hey, everybody, I know we're in the ad break, but we're doing something a little bit different today. Today, I'm going to tell you about an amazing group of people who did not pay us anything to be a part of the show. We just think they do amazing work, and we wanted you to know about them. You might remember back in 2018, those heart-wrenching stories of families torn apart by Border Patrol, refugee children being pulled away from their parents who were in turn deported to their home countries. It was devastating then, and it's just as devastating now, with hundreds of families still not reunited after all these years. You know, we discuss so many problems on Factually, but I firmly believe that there is always something that can be done about those problems. And recently, I came across an organization called Al Otro Lado, which works to reunify families. They provide holistic legal and humanitarian support to refugees, deportees, and other migrants in the U.S. and Tijuana through a multidisciplinary, client-centered, harm reduction-based practice. Since 2018, they have successfully brought together over 100 families torn apart by Trump's zero-tolerance policy. But reuniting those families is just the beginning. Al Otro Lado continues to support each family with legal aid, housing, and counseling to help heal and get back on their feet. I mean, can you imagine the agony of having your child ripped from your arms, unsure of when you'll see them again? We cannot allow such family separations to continue. So if you're like me and believe that all families belong together, then join me in supporting Al Otro Lado and donate today. You can find the link to donate to Al Otro Lado in the description of this episode or go to gum.fm/charity and donate today. You can also consider volunteering with the organization, which offers opportunities that are both in-person and virtual. The best way to get involved is by filling out an application on their website at alotrolado.org/volunteer. Thank you so much.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
All right, we're back with Sarah Roberts. Okay, here's what really steams me is that you talked about how these tech companies want to present this image of, you know, oh, it's being done by a computer, right? And they don't want us to see all of this, you know, this perpetual underclass of workers who they actually have moderating the content. I actually think it goes deeper than that, because what these companies are currently telling us is actually they don't moderate at all, right? When people are making the request of there's hate speech on your platform. Hey, there are false political ads on the platform. There is propaganda on the platform. There is stuff that is harmful to people on the platform, right? Or simply that, hey, the way you've organized your platform is causing bad behavior, right? That like you're throwing a party. The example I always use is you're throwing a party, you're buying the keg. It's your fault that shit gets broken on this platform, right? You created Twitter. So the way people behave on Twitter, if it's bad, it's somewhat your responsibility. We're all trying to tell this to these companies. And these companies are all built on this very understandable early 2000s internet ethos of we are dumb pipes. We don't own anything. Hey, don't sue Google for getting you for, you know, delivering you the pirated content. Sue the site that's uploading it and sue the person who uploaded it and sue the person who's trying to get it. Don't sue the pipes. Right. That's the principle they've been operating on for years. We now realize that that is not sustainable, right? It's not supportable. These are media companies. They're massive media companies. They're the biggest companies in the world. They're run by the richest people in the world. This is where people are getting their news. This is where we're all communicating with each other. And again, they're throwing the fucking party, so they bear some responsibility for it. And they're saying, no, we don't. We don't moderate anything. No, people just post stuff, and that's all they do. Except that they are moderating it. They're moderating it in this silent way that they are then hiding from us and pushing the burden onto this underclass. And if they weren't doing that, we wouldn't use the sites to begin with because they'd be full of spam, they'd be full of pornography, they'd be full of abusive content that people don't want to see. So they are sanitizing it. They are moderating it, is what you're telling me, but they're refusing to own that, and they're refusing to do the kind of moderation that their actual users are asking for. That's my rant. What do you think of it? I'm mad.
I mean, I would just cordially like to invite you for happy hour. And I think we have a lot to talk about. This is one of the most awesome experiences. I feel so validated and seen as a researcher right now. It gets kind of dry and boring on the university campus, but this is what's up. I mean, this is what's up. And here's I'll see that and raise you, okay?
Wonderful.
Yeah, here's the logic. Like, what you're saying is, you know, what the companies are telling us doesn't match. What is the deal? The deal is this. The firms came to all of us and said, we want to take your beautiful human self-expression. We're going to call it something called content. That's weird, but okay. Let everybody go with that. And we want that. And we want you to be able to share that and circulate it and connect with each other. P.S. We're going to go over here in the corner and make some deals with some advertisers. And then we're going to take all that stuff that you think you're making as the clients of our platform. But see, actually, our clients are the advertisers.
Oh, yeah.
So you keep making all that stuff because that helps us connect with our actual customers, the advertisers. Now, internet freedom, information should be free, blah, 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 cyberspace. Like, this takes us back to when I first got on the internet in the early 1990s, where that already was kind of an ethos that didn't seem to really properly fit depending on who you were. Like, okay, well, information should be free, but My friends know that I'm gay on this platform and then I'm getting a lot of abuse from it. So that I would like that to not be free flowing information. You see what I'm saying?
Right.
So like already that was like an ill fit. But the way that they got us all to buy in was by telling us that each and every one of us would have the ability to freely share information as we saw fit. See, that isn't a good selling point to advertisers. Right. In the same way that broadcast television doesn't tell its advertisers, we're going to have a show called Turn on the Camera and Open Up the Studio Door in Downtown LA and See What Happens.
Mm-hmm.
Because advertisers don't want to get matched up with that. So even though the firms were telling the whole world, and in essence, to a certain extent, it was true that they wanted people to upload whatever because they needed a critical mass of that stuff early on, they had to have a mechanism to deal with their clients, their customers, their relationships, their advertisers. And so this is why I think if I had to tell you a principal insight from my book, beyond all the experiences of the workers.
What's the name of your book?
Oh, yeah. It's called Behind the Screen, Content Moderation in the Shadows of Social Media. It's out on Yale Press. Thank you.
Fantastic. And what is this insight?
So the insight that, or an important takeaway here is that the content moderation ecosystem that you and I are talking about, that the whole world is talking about now, exists in the way it does because it is a brand management mechanism for platforms. Are there knock-on effects of keeping you and me from seeing horrific shit? Yeah, that's definitely an upside of them doing that brand management practice. But as we know, it kind of seems like in some cases, some of the most disturbing, provocative, maybe divisive content is actually the stuff that goes viral.
Yep.
So here's the thing, right? Like that straddling of that line and managing that line of where it goes from viral and provocative to a turnoff and a problem for the advertisers, that's kind of what this whole apparatus was set up to deal with in the first place, while still giving the illusion to users that there was no intervention. Because once the users knew there was intervention, they were going to want accountability for those decisions. And platforms operating at the scale that they are or want to be at, they aren't interested in spending the entirety of their time and effort and money on a losing, you know, a non-revenue generating part of the apparatus, which is the cleanup and the and sort of the explaining of that process.
So, yeah. You know, they just want it to happen and they don't want people to complain about it.
Yeah. And so if, you know, there's kind of two better outcomes there. One is let's get people to not even think about it. And two, let's have people, if they do think about it, think it's just computers. And we know people are already, they're already socialized to for some reason think that if a computer makes a decision, that must be the right one. I mean, has anyone seen War Games? You know what I mean? If the computer goes rogue, it's going to start a nuclear war. Right. That was
well. That's just how, you know, it's the example of people, you know, driving, following their GPS directions into a lake, which is a real example from James Bridle's wonderful book, New Dark Age. But like, you know, when we've all been, you know, in a car with someone who's like, I can't believe the GPS is telling me to go this way. Yeah, you don't have to follow what the GPS says. But yeah, I mean, what you're really alluding to is what I realized, you know, YouTube being the biggest example, when, you know, it was sold to us as, hey, everyone gets to upload. This is a new medium. Everyone gets to upload and share. And that's what it's all about. Free expression, et cetera. Now I realize after, you know, YouTube being out for, I think it's 13 years, something like that. No, here's what it is. It's TV, but they don't pay for the content. That's it, right? As an entertainer, that's now how I see it. Unlike NBC, right? NBC is taking eyeballs from people watching and selling them to advertisers, right? The difference is NBC pays everybody. You see on screen, they pay all the writers and stuff like that, right? YouTube gets it all for free. They run ads on it. They don't pay anybody. Oh, except if you do really, really, really well, then you can qualify for a program where maybe you get some of a small amount of money, very small amount, depending on the exact terms that they sort of don't really share with you. They're not really transparent about them. And don't forget that that's just like 0.1% of the people on YouTube. Most people never get that far. So that's the business that they're in. And all of their decision making is being driven by that business model, right? Why would they do and why would they make any decision other than, oh, will this make advertisers happier or sadder? That's it for them.
I mean, as just a thought experiment, people could Google the FCC broadcast television rules, right? For example, for Americans, rules that govern what you're allowed to do and not do if you're transmitting TV over the airwaves.
Yeah.
There's a whole host of things you cannot do. In fact, I think George Carlin made a pretty serious career out of like the dirty words.
Seven dirty words you
couldn't say. Let's take it a step further back in time, which is that the way these companies sort of positioned themselves again, so socially and legally and culturally, was by reiterating, promising, swearing to God that they were tech companies. And yet all the evidence is to the contrary. The evidence is that they are media companies, just like you said. I had the opportunity to be at the Sundance Film Festival in January of 2018 with a film on this topic of content moderation called The Cleaners. And I was wandering around the village. There are all these storefronts there. Companies can rent them out for the duration of the festival. It's a big to-do. And I'm walking around this village, and who's rented out these like primo spots in this little Utah town? Dropbox, Amazon, you know, Amazon, the movie company, because they actually have studios.
Yeah. Right?
Apple, who's just gotten into the game and was in it in other ways. YouTube and Google. So all of the companies that were being represented in this prime real estate, if you asked a layperson or the average person on the street, would say it was a tech company. And that's who was populating Sundance. So there are these like really strategic reasons to call themselves tech companies instead of media companies, to issue all these rules, to position yourself in a certain way to avoid the unions, the actors unions, all of these reasons. And they've been very adept. And it goes back to also the, you know, what you were saying earlier, the 1996 Communications Decency Act that mm-hmm. gave these tech companies of the era this special designation of being immune for or being responsible for the content that passed over their
yeah.
pipes, as you've yeah. been saying. They're empty tubes, as one senator once said. That's 1996. You know, in 1996, I used to call up a business in the city that I lived in so that my modem in my house would connect to his bank of modems, and they'd make a lot of funny noises at yeah. each other.
Yeah.
And I'd move on to the internet. And all that dude did was set up a rack of modems. So modem to modem. And it was called an internet service provider. That's who the internet intermediaries were thought of in 1996.
Or there were universities.
Correct.
Or the government in many cases.
Correct. And what's happened is this incredible privatization, this really, fencing off of these spaces where the firms have developed as they have to their own benefit solely.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they're still kind of trading on all of these other ways, these other metaphors that we had been led to use to understand what these new entities were, when in so many ways they have so many features of many industries and entities we already know. I mean, on the one hand, I was surprised. On the one hand, I just kind of like shook my head like, of course, when I found this out. But, you know, YouTube has for its creators, quotey fingers to yeah. listeners, for its creators of a certain caliber, you get invited to, in all of these metro areas around the world, to a special studio.
Oh, I've been there.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, the YouTube Creator Studio.
Yeah, and you yeah. get access to this high-level production.
Yeah.
You know, maybe someone will help you storyboard it out. You know, that sounds like organic user-generated content to me,
yeah.
right?
Yeah. No, the first time I went there, because College Humor started using that space when I worked there, and I was like, that's actually the first time I clocked it, because I was like, oh, hold on a second. This is a studio. They got green screen.
Right.
They got editing bays. They have all this stuff. We don't have to pay to use it because we're going to upload the thing on YouTube. But wait, here's the other catch. We're not being paid. Nobody's being paid. We get to use it for free, but we are putting in labor. We're putting in our talent. We're buying our own props. We're hauling them there. You know, all we're getting is like, you know, basically a college film studio, with like slightly better equipment. But no one's getting paid. Why did YouTube make that? Oh, because they're trying to increase the level of the content on the platform so they can sell it to more advertisers. They're a media company, right? And like YouTube is, you know, you mentioned, say, Apple, you know, making TV shows. That is, you know, for my purposes, that's Apple saying, oh, we're going to become a TV network. That's the old model. I'm much more fine with that. You know, they hire union crews, right?
Right.
But YouTube is competing for the same eyeballs.
That's right.
And it is, YouTube is competing with Netflix. YouTube yep. is competing with NBC. And they're winning because YouTube is free for the user.
Right.
Or at least it's not free for the user because you have to have an internet connection. So it's like having cable TV. But, you know, at the end of the day, that's who they're competing with, and they're not paying anybody. But then also, like, so in a sense, in a really real sense, we used to have NBC, ABC, CBS, Fox, right? Those companies we knew if something happened on the media that they were putting out that was unconscionable, right? Everybody could get mad at them and we could make them stop, right?
We could say,
it's your fault that you put that over the airwaves, right? YouTube is now one of the, we got Netflix, Amazon, YouTube is one of them, right? YouTube is that big of a media company as NBC, yet they claim no responsibility for what is on the service. So when people were saying, I actually talked about this on Bill Maher of all places, because they kicked off Alex Jones off of YouTube, right? And Bill Maher was doing the thing of, you know, the class, oh, what about free speech? Da 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 da. And yeah, oh, very much. I won't mention what motion you just made, but, now, look, and honestly, he was saying that for everyone on the panel to jump down his throat.
Right.
And so I appreciated having the opportunity to do so. But what I said was like, look, they weren't just hosting it. They were selling ads on it. They were making money off of it. People were watching it and YouTube was profiting off of it. Therefore, they have a responsibility for it existing on their platform. And so it's like fine for them to decide we shouldn't have that. In fact, I would encourage them to have more of that, to not sell Under Armour ads on white supremacy YouTube channels, to take another specific example.
That's right.
But they very occasionally, in the case of Alex Jones, there can be enough pressure for them to actually take those actions. But for the most part, they're like, no, laissez-faire. We don't do any of this. Even though, once again, your research, they fucking are doing it already.
Of course.
There are already, how many people are watching YouTube videos to make sure that people aren't uploading child pornography, right, animal abuse? Like, you don't see porn, child pornography, animal abuse. You don't see it on YouTube, right? Like, somehow YouTube is free of that stuff.
Yeah.
So they are moderating.
They are discriminating about content.
Yeah. They are making a choice, and they could make a different choice, and they shouldn't claim that they are choiceless and that they do nothing.
That's right. And, I think, you know, for any young entrepreneurial type listening, there is a huge market for a different kind of social media that puts its values out front, that doesn't try to BS the whole world about its neutrality while making decisions that absolutely not only favor its bottom line, but I think also are trapped in sort of a twisted Randian, you know, like libertarian pipe dream about the nature of free expression that just is demonstrably false in their own ecosystems. Like, I really do think the C-suite people at these firms are some of the biggest drinkers of their own Kool-Aid around this, right?
I mean, like, Jack Dorsey's like the weirdest man on the planet. And
he just tweeted like 2 days ago, and I retweeted it. It said, hey, fam or whatever, you know, hey, everybody, does anybody know who like the best people to follow about Nigeria are? And I like retweeted it like, oh, like, is that really like what's going on in Nigeria politically? Or I mean, I don't think he's just going on vacation, you know, like, is that really the market research you're doing? Like, what the hell?
Yeah. But he lives in that space of 1996 Burning Man,
right?
Blogger.com. Well, that was a couple years later, but you know, just like, hey, we're all just posting stuff on the internet and anybody can make their post.
Yeah.
And I made a way for people to post. And that made a lot of sense to me in 2000.
Right. Like, and like, you know, the possibly about to be criminally indicted president of the United States who seems to issue policy edicts via Twitter. Yeah, that's totally normal.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, like, you know, that's just, again, you can prove that these prescriptive kinds of declarations about what the platforms are versus how they're used. It's just like there's just a total disconnect. Of course, there's a certain, you know, there's a certain blissful ignorance in that. Mm-hmm. Right. And not having to take responsibility for the thing that you created is, I guess, like a cool spot to sit in as money gets printed. I mean, let's just be honest.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about these content moderators or other people, you know, more of the invisible underclass of the internet, right? Like, we talked about Facebook. I imagine something similar is going on YouTube where people are watching hours and hours of content.
That's right.
Where else, like, what are other places where we see this dynamic that the average person doesn't expect?
Yeah, I would bring up the whole digital piecework ecosystem of platforms like Amazon's Mechanical Turk.
Right.
Where you can really, I mean, this is sort of like the most cynically atomized kind of work you can think of, where people offer services and like anonymous, unnamed people solicit work, but it might just be literally for like, you know, and analyze one image or do one task.
And you get paid pennies. Yeah.
Right. In pennies. I mean, it's just really deeply cynical. And then there's no accountability for anyone. Of course, you know, it's just like the right to work states. Well, the worker can quit anytime too. I mean, okay.
It almost seems like Mechanical Turk, and And like, it's the kind of thing you could almost do for fun, where it's like, oh, hey, here's a little, oh, is that a, it, a lot of the work is sort of like when you fill out a CAPTCHA and it's like, is that a traffic light? And you're like, yeah, it's a traffic light. And then you move on, right? Yeah. Like, it's a lot of stuff like that, or it's surveys or things like that. So people who, the kind of person who, when, you know, they get a phone call, it's like, we're conducting a survey, and they say, okay, I'll answer the survey. Those are the folks doing Mechanical Turk. It seems to me, I understand anecdotally, like a lot of stay-at-home moms who are like, you know, have an hour or two to kill or something like that.
I mean, I think that is a very positive spin on it.
Well, I was going to spin it negatively after that, but I'm sure there's an even darker version.
I mean, I think, you know, you have to think about it. It's a platform that's global in its reach. And of course, there are people who like to, you know, deliver pizzas in their spare time. Right. And there are people who like to, you know, XYZ, do medical transcription in your spare time from your home. But often there are other mitigating circumstances for people to take up that work. Of course, there's a class of workers who want that freedom. They don't want to go to an office. They don't want to clock in.
Yeah,
for sure. That's real. But I mean, I guess I would argue that actually these phenomena have a lot more to do with a fundamental destabilizing of the labor class as a political force, among other things, than any kind of freedom.
That's true. And of course, let me conjure a different person who might be doing this work, someone who's disabled, unable to really leave their home much, needs some kind of income, and doesn't live in New York or San Francisco, so is going to have trouble finding like work at home, like actually good tech work, and just needs, you know, basically this is at home Uber driving for even less money.
That's right.
But even what I was going to say is, even if it is, hey, oh, I'm a stay-at-home mom and I got a free hour a day while I'm watching the soaps, you know, to click on some stuff. A company that's building its entire business model on like monetizing millions of those people is and paying them far less than a minimum wage is still kind of a messed up enterprise, right? Because it's like you're putting in thousands of, you know, you're making use of millions of person hours, right? That you're not paying a fair wage for. And that's bizarre. That
not only are the employees or are the workers, because, you know, they're typically not considered employees, not getting a fair wage. But, you know, there's another dimension here, too, which is like the social cost and the short shrift that, you know, municipalities, states, the federal government gets in these deals where taxes aren't being paid on behalf of employees. Mm-hmm. They're, you know, Social Security is not filled on behalf of the work that they do. It's totally precarious work. You know, even this is like infecting other sectors that were at one time more stable. So, you know, retail sales, for example, where you maybe could know that you were going to have a certain schedule or set hours. Now that's like down to algorithmic determination of the labor vis-a-vis sales, and people don't know until the day before that they're supposed to go in. So, you know, this is like an infection across our social fabric. And I guess, you know, it depends on where you sit. Like one person's efficiency is another person's nightmare, right?
And it's a thing I'm becoming more cognizant of as I use the internet. You know, we are used to, I imagine a lot of folks listening to this, occasionally rolling your knowledge of the horrible way that something is made into your purchase of it, right? So you go to Forever 21 and you're like imagining, okay, I know there's someone overseas, they're being paid very little, and then I know that this is being shipped on a container ship, which is fuel inefficient, and that it's going to be thrown away, and that there's part of this horrible fashion economy. Or if you didn't know that, now you know it, and maybe you'll think about it next time, right? And so sometimes you gotta buy it anyway because you really need a thing right now, you know? And so we're aware of that. But like this one specifically, that behind the internet, there are all of these invisible laborers is a lot harder to see. It's we're not as used to thinking about it. Like one that just happened to me recently was for my recent live show I've been touring called Mind Parasites. It's an hour long one person show. And I had video of it. And I was like, I want to take a look at the script, not the script I've written for myself. I want to look at what I did on stage and I want to edit that. So I said, oh, I'll take the video. I'll send it to a transcription service. Never done that before. There's one called Rev. I just Googled it. Yeah. Okay, great. I've disappointed you already.
It's okay. We all are just trying to live in the world.
Yeah.
That's all we're trying to do.
Well, I had never used this. I had never used one of these services before. So it was an online transcription service. Oh, this one seems like a pretty good, seems like it'll do the thing. I uploaded it. It was $1 a minute. So I paid $50, $60 for my 1 hour thing. I got it within a day. It was a very good transcription. I wasn't like putting it on the web. It was for my own purposes. So punctuation errors were fine. And then I literally just read an article 2 days ago about how they just, without warning, dropped the rates they were paying their transcribers from, you probably know better than me, but something like 50 cents a minute to 30 cents a minute of not a minute of time spent, a minute of audio transcribed, which takes about 5 minutes.
That's right.
So they cut their workers' wages by like a third without really telling them, without even sending an email, just sort of like doing it. And so that made me realize, oh yeah, when I did that, there was a person who had to do that. They weren't someone who was being treated in a professional manner, you know? That's not to say every service doesn't. I use a massage service called Soothe, sends a masseuse to my house. All those people are trained masseuse. I use it like once or twice a year. Okay, you made a face like, oh, I'm fancy.
I was like, that's cool. Yeah.
It's very nice.
And Elon.
yeah, exactly. It's like, you know, it's a luxury I allow myself, right?
It's fine.
And it's better than going to a massage parlor in person. I don't want to drive to a massage parlor. So instead, you just hit the button on the app, sends a trained masseuse. But guess what? You pay an actual masseuse price, and they're a trained masseuse. They're not some fucking gig worker who's like, hopefully they can just press on people for money, right? So I'm like, this person's being treated respectfully. There's a tip included and everything.
Yeah.
But that's not what Rev is, right? It's the polar opposite. And I did not realize that when I was using it. And there was nothing to indicate to me that while I was using it. There was no warning. There was nobody really talking about it at the moment that I used it, or at least I hadn't seen any articles or any tweets about it. And so I was like accidentally using this like massively exploited underclass of labor without realizing it.
Right. And then you were like horrified, I'm sure, right?
Yeah.
Like, so
just like I am every time I go on YouTube or on Facebook with these content moderators.
I mean, so to give an example from my research, I went to the Philippines in 2015 and spent some time in Manila talking to people who are working in call center environments there. And one of the things that they mentioned to me was that, you know, some of them had been working there for a few months, some had been as long as 2 years. And what kept happening to them was that, whereas when they first started, they had like maybe like 32 seconds to make a decision about a piece of content. Mm. Suddenly their manager would come and say, you only have now 13 to 15 seconds to make a decision. And if we don't meet that new metric, this contract is going to up and go to India. It's always India that's invoked. This contract is going to get pulled and go to India. Because if you think about it, just like kind of the math you did on the Rev example, asking workers to only take 15 seconds where they once had 30 is asking them to double productivity.
Yeah.
Or another way to look at it is asking them to have a wage that is halved.
Mm-hmm.
So when you know, the story of Rev or the story of the folks I just described in the call center, there is a common thread. And the common thread is that the power differential between the labor force and management is beyond belief. There's no ability for workers in these current constitutions of work relationships to really effectively push back. Like, how did factories not do this shit to people all the time? Because people like my grandpa, who worked on a factory line for 45 years, built a union that said, we have a contract.
I just had author Stephen Greenhouse in here a couple of weeks ago telling us about the history of the labor movement and how, you know, a couple hundred women died in a factory fire.
They sure did.
And they got together and started protesting, and they, through over the decades and decades, the labor movement fought for protections that stopped that from happening, and pensions and health insurance and all those sorts of things. And now we are back to square one again, seemingly.
Well, let me just neatly tie it up in a bow, because we don't get to a place in 2019 where it's like the entire nation has at best forgotten about its labor history, but more commonly holds organized labor in total disdain by accident. There's been a 40-year political campaign to demonize labor and organized labor as a political entity, starting with Ronald Reagan crushing the air traffic controllers when he took office in 1981. Guess who's running the companies that we're talking about and what their politics are towards something like labor unions?
Yeah.
They are anti-labor because, you know, everybody ought to be free. We're not going to organize up in these weird collectives and like make everybody sign a contract. That's not free, right?
Yeah.
Freedom comes at a real cost for some people on the wrong side of that equation. And I think the result is that we're seeing suppressed wages. We're seeing workers in precarity. We're seeing an overnight thing where somebody's income can be halved with no recourse other than this smart young woman who went on Twitter and was like, hey, I want to tell you about some bullshit going down at Rev.
Yeah.
And she went rogue and posted it and everybody picked it up. And then the media started picking it up. So in terms of like resistance, I want to call out our colleagues in journalism.
Mm-hmm.
I want to call out people in labor organizing, like the Tech Workers Coalition, who are trying to bring together an industry.
Call it in a good way.
Yeah, like raise them up
as
like places, because this has been a like fairly grim conversation, let's be honest, right?
But a fun grim, which is where I live. You know?
Me too. Like, you know, kind of depressing laughs.
Yeah. But I was going to ask you where your places of optimism are. And so I want to hear about this.
Well, I think, I mean, you know, the reason I do the stuff that I do, which is, you know, has weirdly put me in a world that I think about horrible stuff all the time, too, even though I don't have to see it, is that, you know, the whole point of that is to make things better. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And we can't make things better if people live in ignorance about the way things really are. I don't blame any listener of your program for saying to herself, I never thought about this, or I didn't know about this, and I use Facebook all the time, or I use Twitter all the time. That's not on us per se. We were led to never think about it.
Yeah.
So the work that I do gives me hope because I know that I'm making the conversation more complex, right?
Yeah.
And it's only through the complexity of the conversation with real facts and information that we can actually, as a collective, as a society, decide upon what we're willing to accept and what we're not willing to accept.
Mm-hmm.
But if we're living in like a blissful ignorance or buying a BS line that we're being served, why would we think to resist at all? So I have hope around that. I have, you know, I am a just again, full disclosure, I'm a Gen Xer. I'm of a certain age, you know, if you will. I feel like a lot of the people coming up, the young people, are not taking it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
They're like not having it. Unfortunately, I was born.
Because they're the ones doing the jobs.
Yeah, they're doing the jobs, or this is what awaits them.
Yeah.
Crushing debt plus shit work equals no.
Yeah.
Right? That's a simple equation for everyone.
Right.
So that's where that's going to come from. Unfortunately, I learned recently that the year I was born in was like one of the two lowest birth years in the entire 20th century. So when I feel lonely or like misunderstood,
that
explains it. Yeah. Gen X is like forgotten. But, you know, there's a lot of like organic and very real outrage that is being funneled into a lot of resistance, and also not just resistance, but new ways of seeing.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of the young people out there are not just going to take on what's being spoon-fed to them.
Yeah.
They're just not going to do it. And that's, I mean, shit, I'm praying that that's the case, you know?
Well, amen. And and it is, it's one of those issues where once people are aware of this problem and of these people who were, you know, whose work we are unknowingly exploiting, right? That is going to change the conversation. And you know, I mean, the anti-sweatshop movement, right, in the 90s, half worked, right?
Yep.
They all those companies, you know, changed their practices just enough to have plausible deniability, but let's say things got a bit better.
I think they did. And I think, you know, social movements work, but they are sustained and they're long term, and the gains take time. Mm-hmm. But I do think of the anti-sweatshop movement as one really appropriate kind of example. Mm-hmm. Because if for no other reason, I think like the textile industry is really problematic in many of the same ways. You know, a factory collapses in Bangladesh and this industry is fractured so delightfully well that H&M or whomever can really reasonably, again, quote unquote, reasonably say, gosh, we didn't know our stuff
plausible
was made there.
Deniability.
Yeah. And we have to say that's not going to mm-hmm. work.
Well, I thank you so much for coming on the show to tell us about it and for doing this work and for spreading the word that will hopefully result in some change.
I'm really grateful to, be talking to your audience, and it's awesome.
Awesome. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you. Really appreciate it.
Well, thank you once again to Sarah T. Roberts for coming on the show. Her book, once again, is Behind the Screen, Content Moderation in the Shadows of Social Media. I hope you check it out, and I hope you enjoyed that interview as much as I did. That is it for us this week on Factually. I want to thank our producer, Dana Wickens, our engineer, Ryan Connor, our researcher, Sam Roudman, Andrew WK for our theme song, I Don't Know Anything. You can follow me on Twitter at Adam Conover. You can sign up for my super secret mailing list with tour dates and fun facts at adamconover.net. And see you next week on Factually. Thanks so much for listening.
That was a HeadGum Podcast.
Jon Stewart is back in the host chair at The Daily Show, which means he's also back in our ears on The Daily Show Ears Edition Podcast. The Daily Show Podcast has everything you need to stay on top of today's news and pop culture. You get hilarious, satirical takes on entertainment, politics, sports, and more from Jon and the team of correspondents and contributors. The podcast also has content you can't get anywhere else, like extended interviews and a roundup of the weekly headlines. Listen to The Daily Show, Ears Edition, wherever you get your podcasts.